Hello, everyone. Dan Delman here, bringing you a little of this, a little of that. Our first stop today is somewhere in the Arctic. We're going to find the Pole of Inaccessibility. Its location has eluded adventurers for more than a century. I found this article in the current edition of the Smithsonian, and it's entitled The Last First on Earth. Alexander Kolchak is best known as the man who led the White Russian government that opposed the communists in the revolution and who was executed by the Bolsheviks in 1920. But explorers and geography nerds remember Kolchak in a different way. They remember him as the young Russian Navy officer who, just 11 years earlier, calculated the whereabouts of the most remote place in all of the vast Arctic, a spot some 400 miles from the geographic North Pole that he said was permanently covered with the ice fields of the Arctic pack and inaccessible to navigation. Because nothing is more alluring than a place that supposedly can't be reached, the Pole of Inaccessibility would become an irresistible challenge for generations of adventurers, and it still is. Numerous expeditions have tried to cross the churning sea ice to reach the theoretical pole, the location in the Arctic Ocean farthest from any land. They failed in part because the exact location has shifted over the years with the discovery of previously undetected islands. In 2013, researchers using high-resolution satellite imagery and mapping software placed the Pole of Inaccessibility at 86 degrees north latitude and 176 degrees east longitude. In other words, about 125 miles from Kolchak's original. Gareth Rees, who is a physicist with the Scott Polar Research Institute at the University of Cambridge, who collaborated on the new finding, is confident they have it right for now. Climate change and rising sea levels may eventually reshape coastlines and thus move the pole. The veteran Arctic explorer Jim McNeill of England has launched two expeditions to prove that the pole is accessible after all. But he was thwarted by illness in 2003 and disintegrating ice in 2006. This February, though, in the most ambitious attempt yet, McNeill and 28 volunteers will set out again. From northern Canada, they'll travel on cross-country skis and pull sledges that double as kayaks in case they encounter open water. As the world gets smaller, the Pole of Inaccessibility beckons as one of the few remaining firsts in exploration. McNeill says, "I'm amazed that there could still be a place no one has ever reached." Now it's emoji time. About 3 or 4 years ago, maybe 5, in this program, I was talking about emojis. Now I want to bring you an update. 20 years after the first emojis appeared, the illustrated language has really taken over the world. But let's go back about 4,000 years, when someone scrawled a smiling face on a clay pitcher. When it was unearthed in Turkey in 2017, one archaeologist called it the oldest smiley emoji, reminding us that silly cartoon symbols were around long before the first pixelated appearance on a cell phone screen 20 years ago. Today, 90% of people online speak emoji with curious local dialects. Let's look at the 2018 Twitter Hall of Fame. The most popular emoji is the emoji with the smiling face. The Emoji Tracker website reports Twitter users have sent this symbol over 2 billion times worldwide since 2013. But the least popular category has two emojis. The aerial tramway, which you may be familiar with, is more useful in Japan, where it was created, than it is elsewhere. And the input Latin uppercase emoji was designed for software keyboards. A low-stakes battle has broken out. Advocates tweet their favorite to keep it out of last place. Could emojis become our universal language? Probably not. Studies show that men and women use this limited 2,823-symbol vocabulary differently, as do people of different ages and different cultures. Men, for example. Men most often use emojis in private communication, and surprisingly, they're fonder of hearts than are women, and are more likely to repeat a symbol. Women, on the other hand, most often use emojis in social media and in other public discourse. They favor faces and use one emoji or mix and match instead of repeating. In a category which is entitled J'adore, in this graph that I'm looking at, it says in France, the most commonly deployed symbols are hearts. How to tell true love from platonic? Well, here's a guide from Keith Broney. He's an emoji researcher at the London-based foreign language firm Today Translations. He has a continuum from true love to friend zone. And the first closest to true love is the single red heart, most likely a sign of affection. Three in a row, genuine feelings. And then there is the emoji with two heart eyes and a slight smile. More about attraction for you, or your clothes, or maybe your car. And then there's the emoji which is winking its left eye and sort of puckering its lips. And this is sometimes a sign of romance, but it could also be a friendly greeting. And then there is the blue heart, which is probably platonic, often used as a mere ornament to pretty up a message. And then two small hearts, versatile and ambiguous. This looks like love, but may simply be thanks. There is a continuum from true love to friend zone. If you want to read more about emojis in this article, consult the Smithsonian, February 2019. It's question and answer time now. In other words, questions to experts at the Smithsonian, sent in by people who have an interest in a variety of features. And the first question today is from Bonnie Howell, and she's in Beijing, China. She asks, why are starfish shaped like stars? And her answer for this question is, scientists can't pinpoint exactly why starfish evolved to have radial symmetry, with arms, usually five, but as many as 40 in some species, growing from a central axis. However, Dave Pawson, who is an emeritus senior scientist at the National Museum of History, notes that the arrangement confers certain advantages on the animals, which, lacking a backbone, aren't technically fish. At the tip of each arm is an eye that can detect changes in light intensity, and on the bottom are tube feet that enable it to move in any direction. Several species of starfish can regenerate an arm which is lost to a predator or to an accident, and a few can even regenerate a new central disc from a severed arm, as long as a fragment of the disc remains with the arm. The next question is from Lisa Frank in Los Angeles, and she asks, why were teachers' colleges called normal schools? The reply from the Smithsonian is, thank France, because the phrase is derived from École Normale, which was used for institutions that were designed to instill standards of pedagogy and curriculum in teachers-to-be. Debbie Schaefer-Jacobs, who is Associate Curator in the Division of Cultural and Community Life at the National Museum of American History, has said that America's first state-sponsored normal school opened in Massachusetts in 1839, and this at the urging of public education champion Horace Mann. It is now Framingham State University. More arose through the mid-19th century in parallel with the development of public schools, then called common schools. But by the 1930s, most normal schools were calling themselves teachers' colleges. This takes us to the question which was submitted by Ethan Johnson in Washington, D.C. And Ethan asked, the night skies of the northern and southern hemispheres have different constellations. Can you see that difference as soon as you cross the equator? No, says Rebecca Lundgren. an astronomy educator at the National Air and Space Museum. The differences become more apparent as you get farther from the equator or closer to the North or South Pole. Depending on the time of year or your latitude, you can still see many of the same constellations in either hemisphere. At the equator, you can see all parts of the sky if you're patient. The Southern Cross and the North Star will be really low on the horizon and hard, but not impossible, to spot. And our final question of the day is from Cynthia Yount, and she's in Fullerton, California. She asks, I've heard that all kinds of artists used to live at Carnegie Hall. Is that true? Yes, Cynthia, it is. Shortly after the hall was built, in 1891, two towers containing 170 rental studios were added. They provided the hall with an additional source of income, and artists with a place to live and to work. Through the 20th century, the residents made up a remarkably vibrant community of musicians and dancers and painters. Among the better-known tenants were Leonard Bernstein, Marlon Brando, and the fashion photographer Bill Cunningham. The last renters were evicted in 2010 as the Carnegie Hall Corporation moved to renovate the towers into spaces which would be used for archival storage, teaching, and rehearsal. What were some of the big scientific breakthroughs of 2018? Well, one of them was a partial answer to the question, was there life on Mars? NASA scientists discovered the strongest evidence yet that microbial life might once have thrived on Mars. The new evidence comes from two sedimentary rock samples that the space agency's Curiosity rover drilled out of the bottom of Gale Crater, believed to have contained a shallow lake some 3.5 billion years ago, when the red planet was a warmer and a wetter place. The samples contained several complex organic molecules, chemical compounds that contain carbon, which is the element essential to life on Earth. And another breakthrough is helping paraplegics walk. Three people who were paralyzed from the waist down are walking again now after having electrodes implanted in their spines. Paralysis often occurs following a spinal injury because signals sent from the brain can no longer reach the nerves that activate muscles. Suspecting that the spinal cord could amplify these signals, researchers implanted tiny electrodes between patient's vertebrae below the injury and delivered a weak electric current. The results were spectacular. After months of intensive physical therapy, one patient, Jared Chenick, could walk the length of a football field with assistance. "It feels," he said, "like science fiction." And now, witnessing the birth of a planet, a scientific breakthrough of last year. Astronomers captured the first ever image of a new planet being formed. That snapshot, taken by an observatory in Chile, shows a bright yellowish blob, the young planet, which was emerging from the disk of gas and dust surrounding its host star, known as PDS-70. It is some 370 light years from Earth. Newborn worlds are hard to spot because a home star's light can overwhelm any light reflecting off the planet itself. So researchers used a shield to dim the star, and that allowed them to study the debris disk, and spot PDS-70b. While discovering how planet formation takes place around other stars, said study leader Miriam Kepler, we learn as well about the history of our own solar system. And now we're going to into another category of things that we were told from scientific inquiry in the past year or so, and that is things that we should avoid and some things that were good for us. So let's take the first. Perhaps I'll only get through that category before we finish today's program, and I'll bring you the rest as a follow-up in another program. But some of the things that were said to be good for us were saunas. Saunas could be as beneficial for your heart as moderate exercise. In a study in Finland, 102 middle-aged adults with at least one heart disease risk factor, such as high blood pressure or obesity, had a 30-minute sauna session. And afterward, their blood pressure was lower, their heart rate was higher, and their arteries had gained elasticity. Heat exposure can widen blood vessels and improve blood flow, and sweating has a natural diuretic effect, lowering blood pressure. Sauna use is recommended, says the study, and it seems that more is beneficial. Now, something that many of us might not expect, but it's good for us. We're told now that to-do lists can help us sleep. A Baylor University study divided nearly 60 volunteers into two groups before a strictly enforced bedtime. Half were asked to write a list of things they needed to do over the next few days. The other half listed tasks they had already completed. Brain scans were taken as they slept and found that the to-do list writers dozed off 9 minutes faster on average, an effect similar to that of some pharmaceutical sleeping aids. Throughout the day, we have all these things cycling through our head, and that helps us to hit the pause button. It looks like from our clock on the wall that I won't get to tell you about some of the things that are bad for us in today's program, but I can tell you ahead of time that those bad things were bottled water, disinfectants, staying up late, and grilled food, which you might have suspected. So, thank you for being with me today. Very much enjoy your company, and it's good to bring a little of this, a little of that to you, to amuse you and to instruct, if by chance. And in my next program, I'll be leading off with the cause of the California wildfires this past year. Goodbye. Take care. Good luck.